KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor IRANFORM, U.S. Withdrawal from Nuclear Agreement and Path to War, on Friday, June 29th at 6:30 at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. The IRANFORM will feature Jamal Abdi, Executive Director of the National Iran American Council, journalist Reese Ehrlich, and local speakers in a discussion about withdrawing from the Iran nuclear deal. The sponsoring groups are involved in prevention of war and in supporting diplomacy and friendship with the people of Iran. Again, that's the IRANFORM U.S. Withdrawal from the Nuclear Agreement and Path to War on Friday, June 29th at 6:30 at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. It's 9 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned at 10 this morning for Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary. Then at 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock, The Recovery Zone talks to Paul Levy about his new book, The Quantum Revelation, a new paradigm for humanity revealed through the science of quantum theory. Portland area weather is going to be great, near 73 today, and mostly cloudy tonight, and then on it goes into the summer. Stay tuned now, because Political Perspectives features Linda Olson Osterlin, who's going to speak with Medea Benjamin, Code Pink co-founder. They'll be discussing peace movements in Iran and North Korea. That coming up on KBOO, member-supported community radio.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to Political Perspectives on KBOO, 90.7 on your dial, and KBOO.fm if you're listening to us on the internet, which we understand about half of you are. I'm your host today. My name is Linda Olson Osterlund. I'm going to be talking with you about Iran, and actually I'm bringing you an expert on the subject. Medea Benjamin is going to be here with us to talk about her recent book on Iran. It's called Inside Iran, The Real History and Politics of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And for those who don't really know who Medea is, she's the co-founder of the women's-led peace group Code Pink, and also co-founder of the human rights group Global Exchange. She's been an advocate for social justice for more than 40 years, and she's been described often as one of America's most committed and most effective fighters for human rights. She's also won many prizes and been put up for many prizes. She received the Martin Luther King Jr. Peace Prize from the Fellowship of Reconciliation and the Peace Prize by the U.S. Peace Memorial, the Gandhi Peace Award, and the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation Award. She's a former economist and nutritionist with the United Nations and World Health Organizations, and she's the author of 10 books. As I said, her most recent book, really just hot off the press, or hot in ebook method, is Inside Iran, The Real History and Politics of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Welcome to KBOO, Medea.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
We're really happy to have you. I'm glad we caught you. I understand you're on the road this morning while you're talking with us, so, but that's something I bet you can do really well, because you do it a lot.
Well, I'm actually here in front of the ICE headquarters in Washington, D.C., with another demonstration around the deportations and family separations, but I'm delighted to talk to you, and I'll keep you updated on how this protest is going. There are lots of police.
Yeah. Oh, well. You know, we have an occupation going on at the ICE, one of the ICE buildings here in Portland, so many of our listeners will
know
with
yes,
the situation.
You have been an inspiration, in Portland to people all over the country.
Well, that's pretty exciting. And, you know, this was many young people. It seems I've been down there a couple times, and it seems the majority of people are probably, you know, 31 or 32 or under, and as opposed to the opposite, which had often been true in the past of activist movements. So it's a very exciting time in the world right now. It's also a very scary time, and I'm so glad to have you talk to us about Iran. I wanted to ask you initially, Medea, what got you to go to Iran? What made you decide to go to Iran and then write a book about it?
Well, I guess I should back up a little bit and say that I was doing a lot of work on the Israel-Palestine issue and had been confronted a lot of times by people, including my own relatives, saying, why don't you ever focus on these repressive regimes in the Arab countries? And I did and wrote a book on Saudi Arabia. And then people would say, well, why don't you write a book on Iran? And it seemed like a logical progression. And the book on Iran I was working on at the same time that Donald Trump was talking about getting the U.S. out of the nuclear deal, about tearing that up. And I knew that it was trouble ahead, so I thought it would be an important time to be helping to educate people, even those of us in the progressive community who don't know very much about the countries that our government is either threatening to invade or has invaded.
Yes, it's true. We so few of us know very much. I was lucky enough to be tangentially involved, meaning going to the events of the Iranian Student Union when I was in college, and that was back at the end of the 60s and the early 70s. And as a matter of fact, our engineer on our board today, who you've already spoken with, Tommy, her partner is born in Iran, came to the U.S. in 1964, and a couple years ago they went back and took a six-month trip throughout Iran. And I, oh boy, that train's right there. And I had the good luck of getting to hear their stories and, you know, all of the different information about parts of Iran that I would have never thought of or heard of. So I'm wondering if you can't start us off, Medea, with just a little bit of this history of Iran that's led us to this place. Iran is really very important in the Middle East, and I also think most Americans don't really know why.
Well, in the book, I do total injustice to the history of Iran because it's a 2,500-year-old history. Unlike our country, it's got this vast experience and beautiful culture, architecture, poetry, literature. And I jump up to talk more about modern times because it's so critical to understand why the U.S. and Iran have been on this collision course. And, you know, during the time of the Shah in the 1900s, the U.S. was very close to Iran. In fact, Iran was one of the closest allies of the United States in the Middle East. And there was, in the 1960s, Iran became the number one purchaser of U.S. weapons. So it's not, it's more recent history that the U.S. and Iran have been in an antagonistic position, but I think it's important to recognize the economic roots of that. And when you look at how the Shah was close to the U.S. and U.K., a lot of that was because he allowed these concessions for resources like the oil industry to be in the hands of U.S. and U.K. and other foreign entities, which earned him the approbation of the people in the Western world, but led to a lot of inside Iran to change Iranian policy. And that led to the 1951 ascension to power of Mohammad Mossadegh on a platform to nationalize the nation's oil. So your listeners might understand how the Iranians felt about that, thinking that the oil belonged to their people and not to the British or the Americans, and how the U.S. got involved in a coup to overthrow a democratically elected government, to reverse the people's will, to put back the Shah in an even more repressive position, and to lead to making the underpinnings of what would become the 1979 revolution by all the repressions that the Shah was responsible for with U.S. weapons.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that when you read the history, at least the modern history, say going from the 1800s forward, colonialization played a huge role from the U.K. to Russia. Different times they're close to Iran, other times they're betraying Iran. And so it went back and forth, but huge amounts of the oil resources were definitely taken by colonialists right from the start. And I remember that at these Iranian Student Union meetings, actually when the Shah was getting a lot of military aid from the United States, that very much the students here wanted a democratic revolution. They wanted a revolution that would be nationalist in that it would be protecting Iran against colonialism, but also would be democratic. And unfortunately, in 1979, because of the different pressures that came, the democratic revolution didn't really happen in the way that people had planned, and a lot of those who were more on the left had been driven out or not allowed to participate in what ended up coming out. And
one of the reasons for that is precisely because the U.S. allied Shah regime had suppressed all of the secular groups, had disbanded all of the civic society groups, the political parties, the anti-Shah organizations, driven a lot of people into exile, if not into prison, or killed them. And the only space that was available for people to organize internally was through the mosque. And that's how the clerics got the upper hand.
And so we've had an Islamic republic, basically, ever since then.
Well, that's right. And you rightly bring up all these progressives. I, too, went to school with Marxist Iranian students who had been involved in trying to overthrow the Shah, and they felt so betrayed by the Islamists coming to power. So many of them were again forced into exile, and you have a regime today that is run by clerics, although we have to be careful about that and recognize that there is a lot of interplay going on between different factions of the political movement, that there is an element of democracy that doesn't exist in Saudi Arabia, for example. There are national elections. It does matter who gets elected, whether they're from a more reformist a movement or from the more conservative one, like Ahmadinejad versus Rouhani now. So these things do matter, but certainly there is a government in power that gives way too much of the nation's power to the clergy, and has taken away the agency of a lot of the groups that were part of the anti-Shah movement.
Can you talk a little bit about the economy or the economic base of what's been going on in Iran? Because it became industrialized under the Shah's earlier, his father, I believe it was, or his grandfather. It did become industrialized in the early 1900s, just like other nations, and it has one of the largest industrial and economic bases in the Middle East.
Well, yes, Iran it became a well-developed industrialized society with an extremely large middle class.
Well-educated as well.
Extremely well-educated, continues to be extremely well-educated, sophisticated. But the problem of the sanctions has really stymied the Iranian economy. And the sanctions date back to the time of the revolution. While they have been changed over the years, more sanctions, less sanctions, different kind of sanctions. The earliest sanctions started when the Iranian students took over the U.S. embassy at the time of the revolution in 1979 and held 52 Americans hostage for 444 days. The U.S. severed relations with Iran and imposed sanctions.
And that was on the news every night. It was a
every single night.
It was every single night. The hostages are still there. It was a drumbeat. And not to say that we didn't want those hostages out of there. I don't think they did anything to have themselves in that horrible situation except be members of the diplomatic corps that was there from the United States. Nonetheless, it was really, I think if it, that sort of ground into many people's minds of that time period, that, you know, these are our enemies. Look what they're doing to us.
Well, exactly. Just as the 1953 coup is ground into the minds of many about how the U.S. is so hypocritical when it comes to democracy. But you're right. I think the hostage crisis created the mindset that still affects people, certainly older generation in the United States. And the sanctions have had a very, very distorting effect on the economy. It's not only that they have not allowed Iran to import much needed materials, but it is also that it has made the Iran a very corrupt economy with institutions belonging to the military's Revolutionary Guard, the clerics, being the ones that have a very powerful place within the economy. And as Iran is isolated from certain parts of the economic world like the U.S., people become more and more dependent on the government for getting the resources they need. So in a way, I would say it has the opposite effect of what the U.S. wanted to have. Certainly now it is affecting the ordinary Iranian people in a very tragic way. Just in the last 6 months, the value of the Iranian currency, the rial, has plummeted by about half. So people are pretty desperate economically right now, which is something the Bolton section of the Trump administration is very anxious to continue to squeeze the Iranian economy in the hopes that that will lead to the government being overthrown.
Yes. Well, this is Linda Olson-Osterlund, and I'm speaking with Medea Benjamin of Code Pink, and we're talking about findings in her new book, Inside Iran, The Real History and Politics of the Islamic Republic of Iran. I will be opening the phone lines to listeners and people who with comments or questions, but not for about another 15 minutes. So I'll give you that number, but I'm not opening the, because we want to get a little bit more deeply into this before we take questions. So the number is 503-231-8187. That'll be in about 15 minutes. I'll open the phone lines. You know, one thing that I found sort of funny about looking at the history of, or ironic in some way, the history of Iran was, you know, from this side of the world, we looked at when the revolution happened, women had to put back on scarves. And but then in reading your book, I understand that under the Shah, his secularization movement was forced on people. So people didn't have the choice of just beginning to remove their scarves or dress differently. They were basically forced to remove their scarves and not wear them. And so women in that country have been one way or another directly affected in just what they can wear by who's ruling, which we don't usually find that here in this country. And we as feminists found that very strange. And I would say you found women today. What did you find? Tell us what you found with the women that you met and talked with through 2014, your 2014 trip.
Well, it's interesting that the issue of what women wear is so much a part of the political scene, and that women today, especially younger women, they find one of the ways they rebel against the government is pushing the scarf on their head as far back as they can without it falling off, putting as much makeup as they can on their faces, dyeing their hair, and basically wear, if they have to dress, quote, modestly, they wear their clothes extremely tightly. And that's become a sort of a sign of
resistance.
Rebellion.
Yeah, it's a real sign of resistance, isn't it?
Yes, on the other hand, it is important to note, as we said earlier, that Iran is such an educated population, and the women are extremely educated, and over 50% of the university students are women. Unlike Saudi Arabia, where it's hard for women, even if they are educated, to get a job, because until recently they couldn't drive themselves, and also because of gender segregation in the workplace, that's not the case in Iran, and Iranian women are employed in all kinds of things. I had the pleasure doing two of my trips to Iran to meet with an association of women business people, and it was just remarkable to see that they were architects that were in charge of big infrastructure projects, or they were petrochemical engineers with their own companies, or they were had building supply companies and farms that they were running. So all kinds of women in all kinds of areas of life. So don't be very fooled by the scarf. And certainly there are still laws in place that don't give women their equal rights. But Iranian women are very active, educated, and involved in the economy.
Well, that's exciting to know. I mean, I had heard that as well from our friend Tammy when she came back, people she met with. But it's very, you know, it's always heartening to know when women are having a strong position in the nations they're in. I'm going to switch this just a moment to say, you know, their love of education really carries over to Iranians who come to the United States. The estimates, and there's various estimates, I looked up many of them and started writing them down, and in the end I stopped writing them down because there's so many different estimates about how many people of Iranian descent are in the United States. But it's somewhere between 1 million and 1.5 million. And something like over 50% of them have degrees within the first couple years of being in the United States. I think 1 in 4 Iranian Americans has their master's degrees. They in all sorts of other ways, they prove to be the ideal American citizen. They're not particularly politically involved, though, and they don't vote at a high level. Compared to some other immigrant groups, but they enter business and all other areas of life here in the United States that would point to, quote, success. And so at the same time as our government is taking such a strong and negative stand against the nation of Iran, the people of Iran that are in this nation are doing a really good job of, you know, being immigrants and taking on life in another country.
Yes, but let's also recognize that yesterday's Supreme Court decision on supporting Trump in his Muslim travel ban is really going to affect the Iranian people. There was not one Iranian who was involved in any terrorist activities in the United States, and yet Iran was put on that list, unlike Saudi Arabia, where 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia didn't make it on the list.
Say that one more time. How many terrorists have they caught from Iran here in the U.S.?
Zero.
Zero.
Absolutely zero.
Yeah. Yeah, so it immediately makes the premise that they need to protect us from these terrorists coming in clearly not the real reason for putting the ban on Iranians.
Well, that's right, and it's going to hurt a lot of Iranian families who will be separated. It will hurt students who have opportunities to come here to study who won't be able to get here, and it's just part of that policy to further squeeze Iran in the hopes that somehow the people will rise up, overthrow their government, and something, quote, better would be put in place. Of course, that's not how a lot of Iranians see it. Even if they dislike their own government, they see the future as one of chaos and perhaps even civil war if things are done in the way that the U.S. has done them in neighboring countries.
Let's talk a little bit about the role of the United States in Iran and what it's been doing to try to destabilize that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, there's a certain playbook that the U.S. uses in many places. You can even hearken back to Henry Kissinger before the overthrow of Allende in Chile in 1973, saying, we want to make the economy scream. And that is certainly the number one tactic that's being used right now. The U.S., when Trump pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal, not only reimpose sanctions that will not allow U.S. companies to deal with Iran, but also secondary sanctions that won't allow any companies around the world to do business with Iran if they have any business in the United States. And also just yesterday, they warned the rest of the world that oil would be included in this, and they are trying to make it difficult for Iran to even sell its oil. And the Chinese are basically the only ones who can get around this because they have the financial institutions that don't deal with the U.S. and are cushioned. But it means that Iran will be selling at lower prices, that will lose tremendous amount of money. And so economic warfare is really the number one. In addition, there's money that's put in and has been for decades now to try to foment dissent, particularly among the minority groups that live around the border areas of Iran, and there's quite a number of different ethnic minorities. There has been cyber warfare going on between the U.S. and Iran. And then all the support the U.S. gives to Israel that has been doing things like assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists.
Yes, and I believe that most of the Iranians believe that that's the same as the U.S. doing that, that I think five Iranian nuclear scientists have been assassinated, and two of them were shot by gunmen, you know, on motorcycles in the same method who came past really fast. But that's considered to be a joint Israeli-American operation, really.
I think we have to assume that what Israel does around Iran is done either with the total support or at least a nod and a wink from the U.S. government. And that's especially true now under Trump, where we have never, the first trip that Trump did overseas was to Saudi Arabia. He's tightened the alliance with that repressive regime, and in terms of Israel, has become even closer with that one as well. And these are two governments that consider Iran their enemy. So you have Israel, Saudi Arabia, and then the hawks that Trump brought into his administration, like John Bolton and Pompeo, who are working all together to tighten the noose.
And let's talk a little bit about these sanctions in terms of the country is basically surrounded by hostile powers. Afghanistan on one side, Saudi Arabia, a long border with Saudi Arabia, also borders with smaller nations, Armenia and Azerbaijan, but a border with Turkey as well. And so, I look at the map and I think, oh my goodness, Iran is basically surrounded. One of the reasons that they're supposed to be our enemy, according to the U.S. government, is because they have nuclear weapons and we're building nuclear weapons. So can you talk about their nuclear program and what this recent, they were willing to, 10 years, I believe, went into coming up with the nuclear deal, and Trump, of course, withdrew from it in May. But my understanding is that the European signatories have not withdrawn from that agreement, and they're not happy about being perhaps forced into accepting U.S. sanctions again.
That's exactly right. The Iran nuclear deal was a long time negotiating and was considered a very good deal when it was signed, not only by the U.S. and Iran under the Obama administration, but also by France, Britain, Germany, Russia, China. And then it was also approved by the entire European Union and unanimously by the Security Council of the United Nations. So even though it didn't go through the Senate to be considered an official treaty, it did have global support. And in fact, polls done in the United States showed quite a lot of support for the Iran nuclear deal. The international agency that's in charge of monitoring did report after report. It showed 9 different times that Iran was complying with the deal.
Yes.
So, yes, this was considered something that was working. And your listeners should know that Iran never had a nuclear weapon. It never succeeded like North Korea in getting a nuclear weapon, and that the fact that Bibi Netanyahu from Israel was the one constantly calling out Iran about its nuclear weapons research comes from a country that has lied consistently about its nuclear weapons, has several hundred of them, never joined the non-proliferation treaty like Iran did, and would never allow any inspectors into its country. So the hypocrisy is quite astounding. Of course, it's even astounding just looking at the United States and our nuclear arsenal telling Iran that it shouldn't have any nuclear weapons. But
I
the
was
point
reading
is that the Iran nuclear deal was a good one, and it's very unfortunate that Trump took the U.S. out of it.
Yeah, and you know, during the nuclear deal, well, I was reading Trita Parsi, an expert on Iran and Iranian-American, about these issues, and one of the things he pointed out was if the U.S. government was hoping that by sanctions would force them to drop their nuclear intentions in Iran, it was completely wrong. Before we had a treaty to stop those, in fact, the last time that we didn't make a treaty with them, the nuclear program grew to the extent it grew, which, once again, I say yes with you. There was no bomb, but their ability to enrich nuclear materials, et cetera, had grown. And that, you know, the hardliners in Iran are maybe a little gleeful about this latest move by Trump because they want to go back to their nuclear program and build it up. And it certainly would seem to be saying to the Iranian people, you know, you give up, you're making it, and we harm you anyway. So what's the point of making a deal with the United States? But of course, the reason for the deal really was the sanctions, and there was a huge numbers of independent and state-owned parties wanting to participate in the economy just in these few years that we've had it, had the nuclear agreement. So there was really a big influx of companies willing to make contracts and stuff, that kind of thing. And so this current situation is really very dire, and it isn't very well resolved at all. I believe the other signatories are meeting in Vienna next week. The other signatories
well,
to the nuclear.
They've been meeting furiously ever since Trump pulled out to see what they can do. And the nuclear deal is on life support right now. It seems that while there's a lot of tough talk among the Europeans about how we're not going to let Trump push us around and we want our companies to continue to doing business with Iran, they are not willing to confront the U.S. and its enormous power and its enormous economy. At the same time, when they're having trade wars with Trump on other issues, and the Iranian government is saying, if you can't guarantee that your companies can work here and that we will get some economic benefits, we can't stay in the nuclear deal. He's being pushed by the conservatives, as you said, Linda, to get out of the deal. And the U.S. is really moving Iran in that direction, where it will become very, very hard for them to stay in a deal that's already been violated, that brings them no economic relief, and that singles them out for this kind of inspection with other countries not getting that same kind of treatment.
Yes, well, I'm going to go ahead and open the phone lines now, Medea, just so we can get some people in. The phone is 503-231-8187. Excuse me. Please do call with your questions or comments. There's so much to talk about Iran. We have not even touched all of it, and we'd like to hear what you want to know about it and what you want to say about it. So please do give us a call. To me, the situation looks really dangerous, and I'm wondering if Trump decided to trade his desire to bomb North Korea for now his desire to bomb Iran. You know, he seems intent on wanting to be the tough man and have some kind of victory out of being the tough man. So I think the situation is extremely scary, and I think I was wondering about, for people who live here who are Iranian Americans, maybe who weren't born here or even were, and their families, like if you're a student with this new Muslim ban, can you go home on vacations and still come back, or is that an issue you might not know about? You might not know if you could come back if you went home, or could you leave the country on a business trip and come back to the United States? Do you know what the
travel... Well, it depends on what kind of visa you have. But if you would have to get a new one, that's where the difficulty would come in.
And so it would be any new travel visa would be what would be stopping people trying to get here or leave here and come back.
Yes, and you have a lot of people inside Iran that have been waiting for visas, and of course with this new ruling, it doesn't look good.
No.
The same for students, but people who are already here and have multiple entry visas, I think, can go back and forth.
Yes. I'm wondering what it will do over time to the general population in of Iranians here in this country. It seems like it would be so difficult in this period of time, especially with the Muslim ban going through. I think one thing that is a little been kind of obscured in our news media is that that ban was expected to go through despite all of the people putting up resistance because of the history of the way the United States has handled immigration and the executive branch. Our executive branch has apparently got great discretion and has historically, and so it was going to be unlikely that the Supreme Court was going to rule against that ban anyway, don't you think?
Yes, I do. I once was part of a legal challenge around the prohibition on U.S. citizens traveling to Cuba, and we took it to court and went to the appeal court and up and up. And at the end, we lost on the same thing on national security grounds. So national security grounds trump so many other things. And we saw the tragic example of it yesterday. So it was expected, but nonetheless, I think a lot of people in the communities of the different countries that were on the ban are really feeling very discouraged.
And I think that, you know, it's interesting that as the years go by, we see more and more that, you know, that when you change who's in the Supreme Court, you don't change the Constitution, but you sure change what will be enforced and what will not be. And a law is only as good as the enforcement that's there. A Constitution is only as good as it, as it rules true to the... as the rulers get to say what it is. And so we find that we're in situations with our Constitution that don't really seem to bear up under constitutional scrutiny. There were two justices who wrote very scathing opinions about and what this means. But nonetheless, we are in an era when the Supreme Court now will continue to make rulings, I feel, that, you know, the Republicans used to talk about activist judges, but you don't hear them wanting to throw that phrase out too much anymore, because pretty clearly we've got some activist judges in high courts.
Well, we certainly do, and there are people now looking to see what can be done on a legislative level, but of course with the Republicans controlling the Congress, that looks bleak as well, so... One of the avenues we will have to put our attention to is getting a new Congress and, of course, a new presidency. And that's one of the hopeful things that we have to work towards.
Yeah, I you know, you say that word hope, and I do remember a president who wrote that, wrote into the presidency on hope. And I do believe that he was part of the problem in terms of even with Iran. He did come up with the nuclear deal, and we have to give him that. But you know, I can still remember him having crocodile tears for Israeli children, perhaps maybe going to be killed by a rocket from Palestinians, when that hadn't happened in years, and he had not a tear to shed for the Gazans. So I myself, I'm very cynical about voting people in who will actually change the course of our nation, who will actually take something like this and turn it back around. But I don't let my cynicism stop others. I don't want to be a hope crusher. I crush my own hope just fine.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that is that we and the grassroots haven't built up more of an effective movement to pressure them. And in the case of Israel-Palestine, I see that changing way too slowly. But the fact that now you have Bernie Sanders talking about the rights of Palestinians and that the people of Gaza should be able to protest without being shot at, and the sky doesn't fall, sets a bar for others. And while I have been very critical of AIPAC, the strongest foreign policy lobby we have in the United States. I do admire their organizing ability. It's not just money that gives them power. It's the grassroots that they have and the constant rapport that they keep with members of Congress. And I think we should learn from them. And we are building up a much more of an exciting, vibrant movement for Palestinian rights. We have to keep that going and turn it and broaden it to cover some of these other issues. Certainly in the case of Iran, they are very much connected.
Yes, and will you talk about that a little bit? Because certainly one of the justifications for seeing Iran as an enemy of the United States is that they're involved in the Middle East in places shoring up dictators, who would think, in Syria, but other parts of the Middle East. And can you talk about that? That's used as the main justification a lot of the time. They're also been accused of supporting the Houthis in Yemen, though there's very little relationship, in my understanding, between them and that movement, which was indigenous to that area of Yemen. But talk about what is the role of Iran in the Middle East, and what other nations do they help or not help and have that kind of relationship with?
It's quite ironic to hear the U.S. talk about Iran meddling in the region, given that Iran lives in the region and the U.S. has been the one meddling. But given that, it's they're states look out for their national interests. And just as Israel feels it's surrounded by hostile countries, Iran feels the same way. It's a Shia country that is surrounded by Sunni Arabs. In fact, in the old days of the Shah, Israel and Iran were close as well, and both seen as bulwarks against communism and as countries surrounded by adversaries. So in the case of Iran, what is one of the most interesting things right now in terms of the U.S. Complaints about Iran's influence in the region is that the biggest boost to Iran in the region came from the U.S. invasion of Iraq, when you had a Sunni government of Saddam Hussein who was overthrown and a Shia government put in place that was friendly towards Iran. And now you have Iranian-backed militias that continue to operate inside Iran, oftentimes separate from the official Iraqi, oh, did I say Iraq?
Iraqi, you meant
military.
Iraq, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And I think that some of those militias have carried out some very dastardly deeds in terms of things like ethnic cleansing and attacks on the Sunni population. I also think we have to recognize the role that Iran has played in supporting the regime in Syria. In case of Hezbollah, it is certainly true that Iran has a close relationship with Hezbollah, but it has to be recognized that Hezbollah today is a very well-respected political party with the military wing that won its respect from twice having defeated Israel's invasion of Lebanon. So, and then you have the issue of the Houthis and Yemen. In that case, my understanding is that the tribal group, the Houthis, rose up and kicked out the government in Yemen that it didn't feel was implementing policies that were that gave equal weight to the Houthis. And in the process, the Saudis got involved because they were worried that the Houthis, who were practice a religion that is close to the Shia, would be supported by Iran. But the uprising did not come from Iran. In fact, Iran supposedly told the Houthis that it wasn't a good idea to do that military uprising. So I think it's way overblown. The talk about Iranian influence.
Yeah.
The real influence in Yemen has been the Saudis and the Emirates, who have been waging a very brutal war against the Yemeni people.
Well, and the United States, who began calling it a failed state over 5 years ago, I think its intention was to allow it to, or help it create a failed state there. We've got someone on the line, though. I believe we have Ira on the line.
Yes.
Ira, welcome. Sorry to have you wait there for a moment, but I wanted to hear a little bit more about the role of the Iran in the Middle East as a whole.
Right. I enjoy waiting. I spend my life waiting. Well, I wanted to say, I am aware that you wrote this book. I'm talking to Medea here, but I've been a great follower of yours and admirer for a while in other areas. I wasn't aware a long time ago that you had anything to do with Iran, and I did. I actually was Peace Corps in Iran. For 2 years, I taught physics at the University of Shiraz. And and I've also been a member for a long time of the anti-nuclear movement here.
Could you say what years you were in Iran, Medea was asking you?
65 to 67.
Okay, thanks.
The so-called good old days. No.
The secular days under the Shah.
Yes, the Shah was there, but it was after the era when there was a lot of violence from the government in Iran. It was a very peaceful time. Shiraz was a bit like Eugene, you know, out of the mainstream.
Uh-huh.
And it was a wonderful time, and it was a wonderful city. But one thing I always emphasized was an aversion to nuclear energy, and I spoke to this with my student. There was only one out of 60 students I probably had. There was only one person who seemed to think nuclear energy was a good idea. At that time, Iran wasn't very active in it, and I knew people from Natanz, which has some of the uranium, and they, to my knowledge, they didn't have any nuclear industry. But anyway, I always emphasized that. And I've had subsequent discussions with Iranians, and they all seem to be pro-nuclear energy. They want Iran to have reactors and all that. I've always argued against that. I've argued against that in the U.S. I think nuclear energy is a very bad approach, both economically and through safety.
Yes.
There's a lot of energy consumed in the production, in the supply chain, to get nuclear fuel. It's a very bad thing. And Iran is perfectly posited to have, they have incredible resources of solar energy potential. And there's a city actually that came from the Zoroastrian times called Yaz. And 2,000 years ago, they had refrigerators and ice makers that consume no energy. You know, they had, well, I don't know if you know anything
about
that.
So are you wondering what's happened or why they are?
One thing that I think could end the whole thing is if Iran would give up all nuclear ambitions, and I think the U.S. should give up nuclear ambitions too, but I have no control over that, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
But if they just say, we don't want to do nuclear energy, we have all these other resources, there's no reason for Iran to be pushing any nuclear development of any sort, take the whole thing off the table, and in other words, sort of, it's like throwing down your arms and say, I'm not going to carry guns anymore. And just say, we don't want anything to do with the nuclear industry. When I was there, there was no nuclear industry that I knew about.
Are you thinking that if they would go ahead and make that bold move, that would back off the United States from wanting to have, you know, see them as an enemy?
I'd say yes, but I don't understand people in many ways. John Bolton, I don't see him. He's foaming at the mouth. And so there are people that just hate Iran. There's no reason for them to know anything about Iran,
yeah.
You know. The nuclear thing, but don't you think, I just wonder what I will read your book at some point, but don't you think that it would just end the whole discussion to say we're closing down the whole nuclear energy, we're gonna build other things with our engineers, and we're going to use solar energy and all these other things. They have wind, they have solar.
Well, let's let Medea answer that. Let's let Medea weigh in on how that idea might work. Medea, go ahead.
Well, unfortunately, the Iranians see the opposite to be true. They look around and see that Saddam Hussein gave up on his nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction, and look what happened to him. They look at the case of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. And then you look at the case of North Korea, and they would say that the only reason why Trump is talking to the North Koreans is that the North Koreans succeeded in getting nuclear weapons. So that is not a very good scenario for those of us who want to see an end to both nuclear power and certainly nuclear weapons. It is one of the only ways that they can stave off invasion, and that's why some of the conservative clerics right now are pushing for Iran to go out of the deal and to just go ahead and develop its research and get as close as they can to getting nuclear weapons, because that is protection as well as a nationalist right. If other countries can do it, why not Iran?
Well, and don't you think, Medea, that every time the United States does something aggressive, like these latest moves of Trump's and around the sanctions and stuff, that it drives the people of Iran a little bit more to the right? I mean, if you look historically,
yeah,
that's what's
exactly
happened. They become more nationalist. And
that is so true. And even people who don't know or care very much about the nuclear issue in Iran start saying, well, this is our right. If Israel has nuclear weapons, why shouldn't we? Who is the U.S. to tell us what to do? We signed a deal and they broke the deal. So, yes, it brings people together under a banner of nationalism.
And I would like to say, is Ira still on the line?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, Ira, I would like to say that I personally believe that imperialism, the latest stage of capitalism, the one that we're in, will not allow us to stop having a power that's as large an economy with the oil resources that it has, and that has relations with other governments that we're trying to dominate and don't want to be dominated by the United States. I don't believe the United States will ever stop attempting to gain power over that. It's a constant.
Right, but that stands alone. In other words, I would agree with you, but in other words, you're sort of saying that it doesn't matter if they have nuclear weapon or not. They have these other things that would cause the Boltons of the world to attack them.
I am kind of saying that. I think it matters in a different way, because I'm with you. I don't believe in nuclear power as a form of energy production for the, you know, for the humans on Earth. I think it's a big
mistake. It's
like waving
a red flag. It's like painting a target on your chest, you know, and saying, shoot me. You know, there's just no reason for it. It doesn't do anything for Iran.
You know, but poor little Yemen, 5 or 6 years ago when I first started doing stories, when we were still trying to say it was a failed state, and we gave the Nobel Prize to one of the women leaders of it, Tawakkal Karman. But it's been a straight shot from there all the way to now, where Yemen is suffering under extreme bombardment, the blockage of goods to them. All of that's facilitated with the U.S., and Yemen did nothing. It got to be the target because it benefited another one of the members of the, you know, a state we support in the Middle East. So, yeah, I do kind of think that even with or without nuclear power, we would find a way to make Iran a target.
Well, that may be. I'm not addressing that directly, but I would say, you know, if you're carrying a big gun and people are arrayed against you with their guns aimed at you, just throw it on the ground.
Well, yeah, I know. I get the sense it makes that way, you know, in terms of stopping the incident right then, and who knows what impact it might actually have if that was something that could come out of the politics of Iran.
But as I say, I've acknowledged that many Iranians like the fact that they have nuclear weaponry, and I don't.
Yep.
It's just my opinion.
Well, thank you very much, Ira.
Okay.
I appreciate your call.
I would also just say that I've also been an admirer of Tammy's. I know her through her artistry in silver. So.
Oh, yay. You're talking about our board operator, our engineer today. Yes.
Hearing you in Portland. I heard you once. You were here once a long time ago.
Medea.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Well, thank you, Ira. The phone number, and you still can get a call in, is 503-231-8187. Do you think that, Medea, I want to ask you, do you think that there's a chance that the European countries, that some of them will just not go along with Trump, or do you think that Trump is going to... You know, everybody's responding to his threats that he'll cut off this, that you won't be able to import steel to the United States, or you won't. But all of those threats also impact Americans and people in this country or in businesses where those, other tariffs are going to come back, and it's going to make a lot of trouble. Do you think that some of the European countries are going to go ahead and continue to trade with Iran? Maybe not in the key technical areas, but in other areas.
We've already seen that a lot of the deals that were pending with U.S. and European countries have been broken already. There were deals that were quite large with Boeing to sell civilian airplanes, something that the Iranians really need because...
Why, that might be jobs in America, wouldn't it? Wouldn't that be jobs? I'm sorry, I'm being sarcastic, but...
jobs in America.
But you mean Trump just lost us a bunch of jobs, right?
Well, the CEO of Boeing said, yeah, it's too bad we can't do that, but we'll benefit even more from more conflict in the region. So,
Oh my. War industry.
Wins in both ways. But other companies that have had deals, car companies, the certainly anything related to the oil industry, they are already preparing to either not go through with the contracts or wind down their business. So it's a bad situation. The Europeans really don't have the financial institutions and are not creating them that would cushion the U.S., or they could really go to war with the U.S. about this of saying, you sanction our companies around business with Iran, then we'll sanction your companies that are here. But given all the other issues, the other trade wars going on, and how disruptive this is for companies already, it just doesn't seem worth it for them to challenge the U.S. More than verbally on Iran.
You know, and you wouldn't think that in this day and age you could destroy a country like Iran with a 2,500-year history. I actually was looking at where Iran's located, and this is an odd little fact, but I'm going to throw it out there for those of you who care. It's not so far from Georgia, from the Georgia that used to be part of the Soviet Union. And a few years ago, they found in one location in Georgia, they found bones or DNA of Neanderthals, modern human, and a whole nother human species called the Denisovos. And they were all right there in Georgia. And when you think of how old the Iranian culture is, it seems to me that it may be much older than we know. That area might end up being where so much of all of us came from, the mix of different human species that we've actually ended up being at this time. And that reminds me of all the damage that was done in Iraq to the history of human beings on this planet, these ancient civilizations. And I wouldn't think that we would be able to take them down. But if you look at the state of Iraq right now, we certainly were able to take that country down.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Well, let's go with a concluding statement, really, Medea. We're almost at the end of our time. This is Linda Olson-Osterlund with KABU talking with Medea Benjamin of Code Pink, who is at an anti-ICE rally right now in Washington, D.C., which we're very happy to have been hearing in the background through our talk. I'm happy to hear it. I like to hear the sound of protest. But if you were going to recommend to the United States, the people of the United States, what would you have them do about Iran? Just learn more about it? Are there any particular actions you would recommend?
Well, I think we have to make it clear to our members of Congress that we don't, that Donald Trump doesn't have the authority to go to war with Iran without it going through Congress first. And then we have to make it clear to our members of Congress that we don't want another war in the Middle East. I think it's important to promote people-to-people ties with Iran, which is something that we're trying to do, including a peace march if we get permission from the Iranian government. We're also trying to, as I go on the book tour, to build more of a constituency of people who care about these issues and relate it, as we were talking earlier, to the other issues like the Israel-Palestine issue.
Yes. Can you give us a little heads up about where your book tour is going to be going? Did we lose her?
I'm going all over the country. I'm just on my way to Chicago and Milwaukee. Hope to come out to do a tour in Oregon.
We'd love to have you out here.
Look forward to that.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you so much for taking your time today to be with us, Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink. And I'll let you go right now and on with your demonstration. And this is Linda Olsen-Osterlund for KBOO Community Radio, and I want to thank all of you, the listeners. I certainly didn't get very many of you in on the callers, though I do appreciate Ira for calling. But the topic is dense, and I do want to recommend her book for those of you who didn't hear what the name of it is. It was very, very readable and very comprehensive, and it has a it's annotated and has a long list of other reading resources for you in the back of it. I recommend the book. It's Inside Iran, The Real History and Politics of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And if you forget that, you know, I'm sure you can just use your search engine to look up Medea Benjamin and put in books, and I'm sure it'll be listed as the new book that you can get from her. So once again, thanks for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio. This is Linda Olsen-Osterlund signing off.
Just ahead of 10 o'clock here at KBOO Portland. Stay tuned. Air Cascadia is coming right up. After that, the Recovery Zone. Oh, Flashpoints at 10:15 and 11 o'clock, the Recovery Zone. Today, speaking with Paul Levy about his new book, The Quantum Revelation. It's a new paradigm for humanity revealed through the science of quantum theory. Stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to broadcast the 31st Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place from July 4th through 7th at Waterfront Park in Portland. KBOO will be broadcasting the festival from noon to about 10 p.m. every day, and will be broadcasting throughout the state on Oregon Community Media radio stations from Ashland and Astoria to Warm Springs. Again, that's the 31st annual broadcast of the Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place July 4th through 7th, noon to 10 p.m. or so, every night at Waterfront Park in Portland and on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.